So my question is for Dr. Gordon. In years past, I've heard Professor Walter Block say that he believes argumentation ethics bridge the is-ought gap. Do you agree?
Well, I agree that he said that, but... I'm not quite clear how the argument is supposed to do that, because I think all the statements in it are ought statements, so I don't see how there's a move from is to ought. I would think it's more of a rejection of the view that in order to have an objective ethics, one has to be able to derive ought statements from his statements.
So it doesn't do that, but should it?
that all depends on what you think is the correct view of ethics. But to ask that question is, if not a performative contradiction, it's near enough.
So my question is also about Hopper. So if I understand it correctly, from argumentation ethics, you can derive self-ownership. But I'm wondering, is there any value to life?
Well, I think Hans would be inclined to want to ask whose life you have in mind. But I think I wouldn't think that argumentation ethics would rest on an answer to that question. I think we would in general take it for granted that life is good, but the way, as long as the argument is correct, it doesn't have that value of life as either a premise or, as far as I can see, a presupposition. So I don't think argumentation ethics would have an answer for that question.
My question is for Dr. Gordon. On the topic of Hoppe's view of social evolution as a conjectural linear view of history as progression from aristocracy to monarchy to democracy, how is that really any different from a more pessimistic version of Marx's view of history from anarchy, primitive socialism to slavery, to feudalism, to monarchy? And seeing as both of them seem, looking at the historical record, utterly detached from reality, how can we expect to make any logical or really theoretical conclusions from either of them?
Well, I think there are two points that one would need to address in answer to that question. One would be how his theory differs from the Marxist account. In the main difference, I should think, is that the Marxist account is based on taking the forces of production as the primary moving factor in history, and ideas are really taken as the superstructure there, although they're not the fundamental determinants. But Hans's theory is based on how certain ideas have influenced, very much an idea-centered theory. Now, the second point, which you gave as a criticism of both Marxism and Hans Hoppe's views of social evolution, was that both of the views are detached from reality. But I should think that both views are based on assessment of certain various empirical facts about reality. I would think in the Marxist case incorrectly, but it's not at all detached from reality, if you mean not having nothing to do with reality or abstracting from reality. So I wouldn't agree with the that part of the premise of that part of your question.
So this question is for anyone that has the most comprehensive answer or feels like they do. What would be the definition, or at what point would trade or an economy go from being a capitalist one, a socialist one, a communist one? I know Mises said the difference between capitalism and socialism was the existence of a stock market. Is there a fourth option? Well, that's my question. So
I like Mises' answer. I think it's good. If there's a market for factors of production and firms, it seems like that's sort of like the dividing line between being able to calculate profits based on the prices of factors.
So I don't like his answer. But the reason is that I think a stock market back in when he said it was an actual evaluation of the factors of production. I think the stock market today, though, with only algorithms doing most of the trades, I'm not sure there's actual valuation of the factors of production. So I'm not sure the function of the stock market is actually what the function of the stock market was before, or to what extent. That's something for a future grad student to look into, I guess.
We may be misunderstanding your question. Were you asking, is there another discrete sort of institutional form? In other words, capitalism, socialism, communism, Mises recognized interventionism as a discrete economic system. Are you asking what distinguishes one from the others? Or are you asking are there other discrete types that we should consider?
Well, you know, Hayek in The Road to Serfdom mentioned that Germany...
Germany, in his day, nationalized about 50% of German industry, and then he says the other 50% was so heavily regimented and regulated that it was sort of de facto nationalized, and that was fascism, you know, a version of fascism. They allowed private enterprise to exist, but only sort of as a puppet institution for the state. And that's one way of looking at that particular type. And I mentioned this morning that Bob Higgs calls the U.S. economic system participatory fascism because they allow us to have elections, crooked as they are, but we pretend to participate, unlike Nazi Germany and early 20th century fascism.
Yeah, I guess when I think about this question, I like to think about in terms of planning. Like, who is it that's making plans for the economy? Is that done centrally? So we have centrally planned economies on the one end, or is it done entrepreneurially where we have a decentralized decision-making process? And naturally, actual economies, you have some mix, right? Certain decisions made at a central level, certain decisions made at a more decentralized level. So that's the way that I tend to think of it. I actually, when I teach, I very rarely use the term socialism and capitalism. Instead, focus on entrepreneurial planning versus central planning. It's just a way to think of this.
This question is for Dr. Klein, pertaining to one of the causes of woke capital, woke finance, woke tech, and every other industry that you can put with that adjective. Could not some of the blame be attributed to the response to 2008, where the U.S. government either directly nationalized industries until they could supposedly stand on their own, supposedly, or just regulate them to the point of effectively nationalizing them? Could this not have left a mark, left certain individuals in seats of power, and any other things like that that could cause this woke phenomenon to take over these large businesses?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question. I do agree in general with Robert Higgs's analysis of how government intervention grows through what he calls this ratchet effect, right, where during a period of crisis, real or imagined, right, governments take on new powers, they develop new capabilities, supposedly short-term and temporary, you know, to deal with the alleged emergency, with the promise that they'll, scale those efforts back once the crisis has passed. Well, of course, either the crisis never passes, right, or as Higgs points out, in cases where sort of officially, formally, they shut down that agency or they, you know, that regulation is allowed to expire, really what they've done is sort of left those capabilities in place. They're sort of latent, waiting for the next alleged crisis when you can sort of immediately swing back into action and resuscitate those same activities, those same organizations, maybe relabeled with a different name. So you're certainly, I certainly agree that some of the responses to the financial crisis, you know, did leave in place a kind of a semi-permanent additional layer of intervention, bureaucracy, and so forth, and additional government capability. You know, does that explain the variation, the sort of the timing and the cross-sectional variation of wokeness across industries and firms? I'm not sure that it does. The financial sector obviously was a major beneficiary of the bailouts post 2008. And the financial sector is pretty woke, but not as woke as entertainment and tech and retail and some of the other ones that we talked about. But by the way, if I could just add someone, because someone was asking me about this at lunch, another way to kind of express one of the ideas that I was describing in the lecture is, you know, companies can take actions that indulge the preferences of some members of employees, managers, that are not totally consistent with consumer wants when it's not very costly to do that, right? But in the case of finance, it is more costly. In the case of some aspects of tech, like coding, as I mentioned, you don't see much wokeness in terms of hiring and promotion among people who code because you have to be able to write code. But there are other functions where competence is not as close, you know, is not as necessary, PR functions and so forth, where you can indulge your wokeism there. It doesn't really cost you much. In finance, I think having a lot of woke employees, you know, picking the investment portfolio is going to yield a lower return than otherwise and is going to be penalized by the market.
I'll try and keep this as short as possible. Given Rothbard's view of the maximalist sort of position on self-defense from ethics of liberty, plus, this is for David Gordon, I should say, plus Hoppe's sort of Marxist influence behind him, is it feasible to take sort of a Hoppean sort of political economy whereby, given, say, Per Bielen's view of policy as almost, you know, value extraction by a status class, as it were, and that can then be sort of integrated with more, you know, non-libertarian political formulas, or Hoppean Leninism, as I would like to call it.
Well, the view of exploitation that Rothbard and Hoppe, following him, adopt was one derived from the French classical liberals, such as Dunoyer, the historian Auguste Thierry, and various others. So that's based, unlike the Marxist view, wouldn't be based on economic classes, but would view the state more of a independent group of people who are exploiting the rest of the population. So, I mean, one could, if someone were inclined to a Hoppe Leninism, I suppose one might take ideas from Hoppe, but I would wonder why anyone would want to do such a thing.
This question is for anyone that feels like answering it. What areas of Austrian theory and analysis do you guys think need to work in the coming years? Like, what would you guys like to see, like, developed in the coming future?
Well, I think we need more finance people as opposed to just monetary theorists. But
when I wrote a big, long review of David Stockman's book, The Great Deformation, and it struck me that he had a good knowledge of some basic Austrian economics, but he's a Wall Street hedge fund guy, you know, a co-founder of the Blackstone Group and things like that. And so he had a deep knowledge of finance and Austrian economics. And we have a few people who write for Mises.org who have that kind of education. That's one of the things I think I would like to see more, you know, having more finance majors come to this, as opposed to just straight economics, political science, and the usual riffraff that comes here.
Your handsome moderator tonight's a finance major and an MBA, just for the record.
So I hate to think that he's the role model.
Just a quick comment on that. I mean, it's a good question to ask, but when I advise students on research topics, I always think, you know, start first with what you know, what you're interested in, what drives you, what you're passionate about. I mean, you know, not to be glib, but, you know, what areas of research need further development in Austrian economics? You know, all of them. I mean, there's room for development and improvement and refinement, you know, on almost any topic. Or on applied topics, for which there isn't a lot of existing Austrian literature, there's a need for work on that. But everyone in the room, each of us could be doing these research projects for 20 or 30 years, and we wouldn't exhaust them. So, I mean, yeah, it's useful. It might be useful for you to choose a topic that other people are also interested in, but there's so many of those. I would start with what you know. If you have deep industry knowledge, or knowledge of some specific phenomena that you can bring to bear, that's probably, you know, more important, that and your passion, your interest, than trying to figure out, oh, well, here's the area that needs more work.
Yeah, and I think one area that I would also add is non-Austrians are always coming up with ideas that we need to think about integrating or refuting, right? So, and we are outnumbered by everybody else, so there's always somebody you can read and say, okay, they got this right, but we can fix, tweak here and there, or they got this totally wrong, we need to refute that. So there's always room there for something to be done. Yeah.
His question is for Dr. Rittenauer. I grew up in the Rust Belt watching the decline of American manufacturing. My dad was in manufacturing. So I'm curious, the popular or mainstream view, it seems to me today, sort of Trumpian view, is, well, we should have raised tariffs sooner, or we should have done more to protect industry. Globalism's the problem. If we just let free trade happen, you know, everyone making $4 an hour will take all the jobs. I'm curious, what, in your view, what's the sort of Austrian explanation for the hollowing out of the industrial base in America, and what's the sort of refutation of we need more tariffs?
Well, I'm not an expert on that particular industry, so I don't know about in terms of the nuts and bolts of why things happen the way they happen specifically. But one thing that we do know is, I mean, wages are determined by the marginal productivity of the workers, and so what are they contributing, and then the price of the products, and that's the key determinant. Now, I could tell from my, you know, some there's a whole host of things that were going on at that time. I think the success of unionism was a key. It helped put my father out of work. The unions priced themselves out of jobs in many respects. One of the things that I didn't even get time to in the lecture is whenever there's a change in market data, there are winners and losers. When you remove tariffs, there is going to be an adjustment process. And there are firms that are operating based on the existence of those tariffs, that when the tariffs are removed, if they're less efficient than at the margin, the less efficient firms are going to have to do something else. And then the workers are going to have to do something else. And some workers may have to take employment elsewhere. They may have to move away. I mean, that's what my father ended up doing. I had to move away. Once he just changed jobs completely. So those adjustments will take place. There's no way to freeze a situation the way it was for decades. That's one reason why, say, people like Porter de Soto note that it's important to keep labor markets and factor markets as flexible as possible to allow these transitions to be as smooth as possible. I don't know the specifics well enough to explain what happens in the Rust Belt in every circumstance. But it seems to me, and this is not a prejudice, it's a result of analysis. The best thing to do is keep markets free, And as markets are kept free, people will find their way in the market division of labor to the betterment of themselves and to society as a whole.
I want to add a footnote to that. In Hayek's book, Law, Legislation, and Liberty, Volume 3, he makes a comment that I've quoted several times in some of my writings because it makes so much sense. He says, if you want prosperity, then when the time comes for you to change and adapt, you need to do it. If not, you're not going to have prosperity. So you need an ethic in society where people understand the world is changing and I need to change with it, like Sean's father, the story that he told, because the alternative is, well, you're going to forego prosperity. And also keep in mind about tariffs. Tariffs are something that we do to ourselves what our enemies try to do to us during wartime. The embargoes, blockades, to starve us out economically. So be careful not to fall into that trap that Donald Trump has fallen into.
Thank you all for your talk. My question is for Dr. Newman. Based on your lecture about the quantitative analyses, do you think that there's any room within the Austrian tradition for quantitative analysis or econometrics, or should it be something that's kind of more or less abandoned or kind of thrown out?
Oh, I definitely think that there's room for statistical analysis, including econometrics. The trick is just knowing how to interpret the results in that innocuous way that I mentioned and from Hoppe's article that I had cited, which is that when you have data lined up and you see the correlation or the coefficients in your linear regression, you're only relating data points that existed in the past. So you're analyzing something that happened in the past. We can't assume that there's any sort of constancy, especially if it's the result of human action. So if you have data, I think that it can be fruitful to do regressions and learn things about the past. Lucas Engelhardt is nodding his head. I'm actually thinking about an article that he wrote in the Quarterly Journal of Austrian Economics, in which he did that. It was entrepreneurs become fools or do fools become entrepreneurs? And he's got a regression at the end of that where he's highlighting that it does look like that entrepreneurs become foolish and fools become entrepreneurs. So it's a good example of using regression in a helpful way.
My question is for Dr. Rittenauer. You mentioned a foreign good being sold for $40 and a domestic being sold for $60. My question is, how would the quality of a product change that, if at all? If the domestic good is a higher quality or if the foreign good is a higher quality, would that change the way consumers look at it or how a tariff is enacted or if nothing changes at all?
Yeah, that's good. There are many different margins, if you will, characteristics that people use to that people value goods for, right? So on the one hand, goods are perceived subjectively by people based on the what ends that they can satisfy with them, what quality they're looking for. Different goods that are different quality tend to be perceived different quality as perceived by the potential buyers are perceived as different goods, and so it would not be unlikely for the prices of those goods, goods of different quality, to be differently priced. Now, it kind of depends on, it depends on how the state classifies those goods and where does the tariff apply to these goods of different quality, if they apply to them uniformly or not. The same general principles, it seems to me, apply, that if whatever goods the tariff apply to, regardless of the quality, the price is going to be artificially high. And so if the people are factoring in quality to their choices to begin with, those changes in quality and the impacts on people's choices would be reflected in a pre-tariff situation, and then the tariff would just add to it. So you'd have the same the economic impact, it seems to me. The tariff will make whatever product the tariff is assessed against will make it more costly and less attractive to the buyer, regardless of what it is.
So this is for whoever wants to answer it, but what's the biggest disagreement among contemporary Austrians that we could look into ourselves? And I guess more specifically, what's the biggest disagreement among, you know, Austrians associated with the Mises Institute versus, you know, other things, right? Like, what do you guys disagree on?
I think it's neckwear, I think, is the...
Should David Gordon be given the Nobel Prize? I argue that all the time.
Somebody thinks yes.
Well, one debate that I love is the fractional reserve banking debate. That's fireworks go, but I like the fireworks. They're fun.
Debate is a good thing, by the way. It's how we advance our understanding and flesh out the truth about how the world works. So it's a good thing that there's debate about fractional reserve banking and other things.
Yeah, I think there's a surprising amount of disagreement, sometimes implicit rather than explicit, even on basic, you know, basic microeconomics, basic price theory, that, you know, there's a strong commitment here to embracing the particular approach to price theory pioneered by Menger and elaborated by Bohm Bawerk and Mises and Rothbard. I meet many scholars and people I know who identify as Austrian economists, but essentially use a very standard Walrasian or Marshallian kind of apparatus to understand markets and prices. Then they layer on top of it dispersed knowledge, or they layer on top of it Kirznerian discovery. But essentially their mode of analysis is the same as what you find in the sort of neoclassical tradition. So the idea that there is a distinct Austrian price theory is something that not all contemporary Austrians seem to accept.
My question is for anyone who wants to answer, but I've had a discussion with a couple people today on the topic of what is meant by subjective valuation in the Austrian school and whether that applies ontologically, that we're talking about the essence of a thing, that there's not like that there's not a substantive value ontologically, or if we're just meaning in terms of markets. And from my understanding, it's that the Austrian school is not making a relativistic claim ontologically, but I just thought that would be helpful clarification, since whenever I had a discussion about that a couple times, it seemed like that wasn't clear. Thank
you. I would say your understanding is correct. Your understanding is correct that Austrian economics is not committed to any view about the ontology of value. It's just strictly, it strictly deals with people, their valuations in the market, and in their individual life, but it's not making any commitments. In fact, you could say for Austrian economics, ontological is a four-letter word.
I mean, I would say the easiest, what I tell my students, the easy way to think about it is subjective merely means personal. It's a personal valuation based on one's own preferences. And it doesn't mean anything more than that.
By the way, there's a similar confusion, not at this conference, but out there about concepts like individualism, that, oh, people who are in favor of markets and decentralization support, you know, so-called atomistic individualism, some kind of ontological belief that we are all isolated from our fellow person. I mean, obviously, Austrian economics doesn't assume anything about whether people will prefer voluntarily to associate themselves into particular groups, to identify with group characteristics or individual characteristics, to form social bonds and so forth. That's all part of voluntary market interaction.
All right. Thank you, everyone.